Hello and welcome to Martian Drive-In Podcast number 19. My name is Terry Frost, and this time around I'm going to be just shooting the shit with a couple of friends. I'm going to be having a chat with Danny Danger Oz, a friend of mine from up in Coomera in New South Wales, and with Paul Poulton, who has been on the Martian Drive-In Podcast one other time. We're going to be talking genre films, we're going to be talking actors, we're going to be talking Botox, we're going to be talking all sorts of things. Just in general, three guys sitting around and dissecting cinema. So sit back, get yourself a beer or a cool drink, and we will have ourselves a little bit of a chat. And we'll start that right after the credits. The Martian Drive-In Podcast appears every 4 weeks. It's a podcast of speculative fiction, fantasy, and horror appreciation. Feedback's very important, so it's Soylent Green, in fact, and you can give feedback via my email address, cultguru, K-U-L-T-G-U-R-U, @gmail.com. You can find the Paleo Cinema Cafe on the Book of Faces, or you can send a voicemail to area code 206 338-9397. Now, occasionally we do get some adult content on this podcast, so if you're easily offended by that, then you need to lighten up and accept the fact that the world is a diverse and wonderful place. And I've got two guests at the moment. I've got Danny Danger Oz from Coomera, is it?
Yep, Coomera. Hello.
And I've got Paul Poulton from down in the southern suburbs. How are you, Paul?
Evening all.
Yep, so basically we're going to have a bit of a chat fest here, just shooting the shit with friends, having a bit of a good time, and probably scandalously slandering as many people as we possibly can in this sort of format. Okay, so we're going to start off. News, basically, I'm back on the radio in Darwin.
Yay!
Yep, so we've got a little bit of a different format this time because they changed the formatting up there at ABC Darwin that the afternoon guy does the movie stuff, and Ivor, that I was doing it with in the evening, he and I had a bit of a talk around after a couple of months of nothing and decided we're going to do movie music in the evening. So we're going to have about a half an hour once a week just playing some movie music and talking around it and shooting the shit that way.
Cool.
That'd be good.
Yeah, it's great to be back on board, and apparently they got a lot of emails and letters saying, "Where's Terry?"
Oh, that's nice.
I'm quite pleased by that.
Yeah.
And we're also doing this other thing. They're doing a once-a-week thing with a whole bunch of people where they're doing My Life as a playlist. So each week they have a theme. Like last week they did love and loss, you know, losing lovers and things like that, and a piece of music that relates to that. And they had about 8 or 9 different people talking about their piece of music and playing it as well.
Okay.
So I got involved with that. There were people like me and Marsha Hines and a bunch of other people like that.
I remember they've done like a, you know, was a life-changing moments or something that, you know, what's a song that sticks with you because it, you know, something major happened in your life or whatever.
Yeah, they do. It's kind of like that, but they're going to do a different theme each week. So there's going to be one for birthdays. There's going to be one for funerals. They're going to do about 6 weeks of that kind of stuff, and I'm doing 5 minutes of that, and then about a half an hour of the other thing. So it's good to be back on board. You kind of miss it when you don't do it.
Yeah,
and it'll be nice to actually see some you know, I suppose movie soundtracks looked at as opposed to just the movies. So.
Yeah, we're doing a bit of that. We're starting off a bit differently because we're going to do actors singing really badly.
Oh, no.
Yeah. So we're going to do, like, Lee Marvin singing Wandering Star from Paint Your Wagon.
I love Lee Marvin singing Wandering Star. The fact he can't sing is what makes it.
That's what I mean. The thing is, I'm not going to go from the Schadenfreude thing, you know, like misery at someone else's happiness and someone else's misery. I'm going to go the fact that these people are gutsy enough to go outside their comfort zone, and yet they sometimes fuck it up.
Don't forget Fraser Hines' single.
Who's?
Fraser Hines.
Is he Marsha Hines' brother?
No. The guy who played the, was one of the very first Doctor Who companions.
Okay, well, yeah, that's a little obscure for our thing, I think.
Science fiction, yeah. Jamie, he was, I think he was the second Doctor's companion, but he released like a Doctor Who single, which, yeah.
It wasn't good?
John Pertwee's was better, put it that way.
Yeah, but yeah, I'm gonna have such fun with this though, because I've got another one where I've got Clint Eastwood singing "Accentuate the Positive."
Gather round me, everybody. Gather round me while I preach some. Feel a sermon coming on me. The topic will be sin, and that's what I'm again. If you want to hear my story, then settle back and just sit tight while I start reviewing the attitude of doing right. You gotta accentuate the positive in eliminate the negative and latch on to the affirmative and don't mess with mess in between. You gotta spread joy up to the maximum and bring bloom down to the minimum. Have faith or pandemonium liable to walk upon the scene. To illustrate my last remark, Jonah in the whale, Noah in the ark. What did they do just when everything looked so dark? Man, they said we better accentuate the positive and healing. And ain't that negative, latch on to the affirmative and don't mess with Mr. in between.
Actually, Clint Eastwood's not a bad singer. I pulled together some of his stuff for a Cowboys playlist that I was doing. And, you know, he released an album, and I was it San Antonio Rose was one of the ones I found of his. And I went, that's not bad, actually. I mean, it's not, you know, great, but...
Yeah. If he wasn't Clint Eastwood, if he wasn't Clint Eastwood, he wouldn't have got a gig. But, yeah, I know what you mean.
I want him to sing Accentuate the Positive a la Dirty Harry.
Well, I'll send you the MP3 so you can listen to it for yourself, because it is quite fun. But and I've got the ultimate, which is Ricardo Montalban singing a little novelty song called Chihuahua. What is it? Chihuahua Choo Choo.
Have you had that on your podcast before?
I may have,
because I remember hearing it, and I'm fairly certain you're one of the few people who would have played it.
Yeah, so I'm going to be playing that on the radio as well, and it's going to blow Ivor away, because everyone's talking about how he was a better cunt than the other guy and all that kind of shit.
Well, yeah.
So I'm going to throw that up at them, and a few things like that. So we're going to have fun. We're doing about 8 weeks of that, and then we're going to get into novelty songs, and then we're going to phase into movie music. And I'm looking at a whole bunch of different stuff, including some French composers that did really good movie music for like fantastic films in the 1960s.
Mm-hmm.
So we're doing a little bit of that. So what have you been up to, Danny, besides being a daddy?
Mostly being a daddy, because I'm a stay-at-home dad these days. Though I really not too much, although I did, I'm enjoying showing the kids good stuff. And so
that's cool.
It took over 2 days, but I showed them their first Western, which was mm-hmm. Gunfight at the OK Corral.
Was that the one with Burt Lancaster and Kirk Douglas?
Yep, that one, 1957.
Okay.
And they both loved that as their first Western, because I actually want to show them a chunk of the, you know, like the Good, the Bad, and the Ugly, and all those sorts of spaghetti Westerns, the good ones.
Mm.
But you kind of need a grounding in Westerns first to really appreciate how different the Italian take on it was.
No, that's fair enough, too. I might have to throw you a copy of The Thief of Baghdad, the 1941.
I've got it.
Okay, I would definitely play that for a kid.
Yeah, I did. I actually, because years ago I asked you for recommendations for good kids films, and that was one of them that you recommended. So
absolutely.
So I picked it up and showed it to them.
And, great, because that's just magical stuff.
Yeah, well, they've been brought up watching a lot of old stuff as well as modern stuff, which means they don't turn up their nose at older film styles or black and white stuff or anything like that, you know, so they love the original King Kong.
Fantastic. Don't you want to punch people who say they don't like black and white films?
I just think it's sad for them, really, because it's like...
I want to punch them.
No, I just think, well, you're cheating yourself.
You're missing out.
Yeah, who cares if it's... It's like, it'd be like someone who was a mad 3D buff saying, I can't watch a film in 2D anymore. It's like, what, yeah, a really great film in 2D isn't worth watching just because it's in 2D?
Yourself. Well, like, you know, it's like that Schindler's List movie. I mean, you know, black and white, get over it.
Well, there's little bits of red in it.
Oh, shit. Or the Elephant Man, you know.
People cripple themselves. There's a psychological phenomenon where people get snobby about things and miss out on good shit.
Yeah. Well, it was like people used to say that they, when widescreen was finally starting to become a regular thing on DVD, you'd have people saying, I can't stand it. Those black bars at the top and bottom of the picture, yeah, I find them really distracting. And it's like, well, you've got a whole bloody room around the picture. If you're distracted by black bars, how are you coping with a whole damn room with bric-a-brac and bookshelves and goodness knows what else? It's just...
Yeah, and eventually the TV makers went the right way and made widescreen TVs. But I remember hearing that a lot too when I was working for Foxtel.
Actually, I think that's rather ironic that now that we've got the widescreen television, if you go back and you look at some of the early TV episodes that weren't formatted for widescreen, and unless your TV will cope with reformatting it itself, you end up with a stretched picture. So you've got sort of the reverse happening of what they used to do when they put the widescreen movies on the TV and scrunched them all up.
Where everyone looked like they were 10 foot tall.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, that's the other problem we had too. I got a call when I was working for Foxtel back around the millennium. Somebody said, why didn't you play Gone with the Wind widescreen? And I told them it wasn't in widescreen.
Yeah. Well, that's it. Yeah, some of the old films are in a, if they're not in a 4x3 format, it's like, you know, 4x5, or it's very close to TV scale.
That's it. The widescreen movies didn't come until the early 50s anyway.
Mm.
So anything done before then, Wizard of Oz, all of those, were in the Academy ratio.
Yeah.
Yeah. So what have you been up to, Paul?
Mostly just sort of work, school, and occasional radio broadcasting. So.
Oh, cool. What, you're still doing those radio plays, aren't you?
Yeah. I'm part of an online radio network called Radio Real. I do an audio drama broadcast depends on what it's like this week. And then once a month, I usually do some sort of themed. I've been doing one that's a themed swing and big band revival style with some, you know, original stuff, and another one that's a monthly novelty music themed one. So when you get to do your novelty music, hit me up.
Oh, definitely will, because I've got a whole bunch of stuff, and I've actually bought Sal a book about novelty songs at one stage, but any of the input I can get would be fantastic as well, and I'll name check you on the radio if you do.
Sure.
Yeah, so, okay, so we'll move on to what people have been watching. I'll go last because I'm the host and I'm being gracious. Paul, what have you been watching lately that's tickled your fancy and fancied your tickle?
There's nothing that sort of, I suppose, really jumped out. I finally got around to seeing, I think, Kick-Ass 2 and World War Z. I refuse to call it World War Z. That I had missed out on. I was rather impressed with the Superman reboot, which finally I got around to seeing a couple of months back. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's probably about it. Okay. And Avengers, Iron Man, etc. So,
yeah, all of the Marvels. How about you, Danny? What have you been watching when you've had a chance to, beside Gunfight at the OK Corral, which we all recommend for everybody?
It's an awesome film. It holds up so well.
You know the best bit in that? There's a bit where Burt Lancaster does a rolling dive.
Yes.
In the gunfight, and it's magnificent.
My son actually just went, whoa, when he saw that. So.
It's great stuff. So what else have you been watching, mate?
I rewatched a month or two back. I rewatched John Carpenter's In the Mouth of Madness, just because I remembered I'd watched it and I couldn't remember anything much about it. And when I rewatched
that was,
it,
that
I
was kind the of, Sam Neill one.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I kind of came away from it and went, "Yeah, this the exact same script in the hands of a different director would have been much better." Okay. And I'm a John Carpenter fan, but I just kind of went, "Yeah, he lacks subtlety. He can't do subtle." And no. But from there I've sort of gone into watching a lot of sort of cosmic horror or Lovecraft inspired films. So things like Yellow Brick Road and Uzumaki, which is a Japanese thing based on a manga, and a couple of essentially fan made films, The Whisperer in Darkness and Call of Cthulhu, made by the H.P. Lovecraft Historical. Historical Society. And
I haven't caught up to those yet.
They're quite good. My biggest issue with them is just that I've watched a lot of old cinema, so I can see that the way they've tried to film them in the style of how things were filmed around the period the stories were written. So late 1920s, early 1930s. And so one of them's actually a silent film. And, you know, and this is being picky because it's essentially an amateur production, yeah, a high quality amateur production, but you can tell that they don't know what colors to use to work well with black and white.
Okay, yeah, so the gray scale looks a bit off.
Yeah, and things like that, but that's being picky, and I mean, hell, you know, The Artist that came out a couple of years ago had the same problem. So I mean, yeah, a major Hollywood film that had millions of dollars spent on it compared to these lower budget films, and they're actually quite good. Call of Cthulhu I thought was okay, but The Whisper in Darkness I thought was actually quite creepy at times, and it built really well, and I enjoy that, but I've been enjoying going through those and just finding odd creepy films and things. And the other night we went and saw The World's End at the cinema, which I enjoyed. And
yeah, I saw that last night. I was spoiled a bit by the Chinese subtitles I had.
Oh, okay. But, You've got to stop going to China to watch films, Terry.
Yes, I know that, but I get the frequent flyer miles.
Okay.
Yeah, but I quite enjoyed that too. I mean, Nick Frost kung-fuing people with a pair of bar stools is always great to watch.
Yeah, I think out of the three films that they've sort of done as a team, I think it's probably their weakest, because the first half I find a bit rough, but it's still the sort of comedy. It's still a really clever comedy and a really different comedy, and definitely the sort of film that the Yanks wouldn't make.
Absolutely, yeah, because it would turn into Porky's if they did it.
Yeah.
Yeah, but no, I didn't mind it. I mean, I liked the third act of it. That all kind of worked quite well.
Mm.
And without doing any spoilers on it. So what have I been watching? I've actually got my Mizo up here, so it'll tell me what I've been watching. And there's a couple of quite interesting things here. I saw a thing called Now You See Me, which is a kind of team of magicians who pull off a robbery.
I've seen some reviews for that, but I haven't actually seen it yet. So
it's got Woody Harrelson in it. It's got Mark Ruffalo in it and a few other people. Isla Fisher, who's married to Sacha Baron Cohen. And it's quite fun. It's got a twist in the third act I didn't pick. Maybe I was tired at the time because I'm usually pretty good at that sort of thing. But give it a go and let me know what you think, people, because Now You See Me is quite interesting. It didn't get great reviews, but I kind of like stylish capers.
Mm.
And this one definitely clicks that button.
It was one that I was interested in. It's just finding the time to get to the cinema, but it's one of those ones that's definitely going on the list of films I'm going to watch at some point. Because a good heist film or caper film is just a joy.
Yeah, I'm not going to do any spoilers on it, but I did like it.
Actually, your Chinese subtitles reminded me a couple of months back I saw a film called Tai Chi Zero, which is a Chinese steampunk movie.
Cool.
And it's actually interesting to see, a non-Western culture's take on the whole steampunk, you know, phase that's going through everything at the moment.
There are a couple of good Japanese ones out there too, as well as Chinese.
Mm.
So I'm trying to think of the name of one, but I can't off the top of my head. The other thing I'm going to mention that I saw, I watched a Tarzan movie from the early 60s called Tarzan's Three Challenges with Jock Mahoney playing Tarzan. He was like in his mid-40s playing Tarzan. He was quite a healthy guy.
Yeah.
It's set in Thailand. It's got Woody Strode as the villain, with Woody Strode's voice dubbed by some English actor. But it's got these great set pieces where Tarzan has these challenges to shoot arrows into tennis balls at great distances, and it ends with a fight between Woody Strode and Jock Mahoney.
Mail call, sir.
Hey?
Sorry.
Yeah, it's got a fight at the end between Woody Strode and Jock Mahoney. They're fighting on a great big rope net over pots of boiling oil.
Oh, wow.
And it's just terrific stuff. Jock Mahoney's health got really knocked by this movie because being a kind of a jock kind of guy called Jock, someone dared him to swim across a river in Thailand. He got amoebic dysentery, dengue fever, and pneumonia out of it, and his health was never the same again.
Oh, bloody hell.
So Tarzan in the movie drops about 20 kilos in various scenes. But it's a great little action film, and it's just outrageously silly. And I really enjoyed watching it. It's widescreen. But, and it's set in Thailand rather than Africa. And it kind of really does work well as a kind of Saturday afternoon matinee kind of film.
Hmm.
Okay. So let's move on. There are a couple of themes I wanted to do in this podcast. First one is Ender's Game is coming out soon. And Orson Scott Card has been in the media for being basically a total dick.
For all the wrong reasons.
Yeah, for being a total dick, homophobic, right-wing, nutter. And Lionsgate, the studio who made the film, basically want him to shrivel up and die. So, are you guys going to see this in the cinema?
Well, for me, getting to the cinema is quite hard these days, so I often wait for reviews before I go see something at the cinema. I've seen the trailer for it though, and forgetting all the Orson Scott's Card side of things, the trailer just didn't really inspire me.
It looks a bit like a science fiction movie from 10 years ago to me.
It might be really good, but I've noticed that recently. Actually, I've seen a few films where the trailers I thought were really crap and the films were good, and vice versa. Mm. And I'll wait to see what people say.
I may torrent it, but I've had a policy for the last 20 years, literally, of not giving any money to Orson Scott Card because I saw a lot of the stuff he wrote in the very early 90s, which was incredibly homophobic.
Mm.
and I kind of made that conscious decision not to give him my money.
Well, I think I read Ender's Game might have been the late 80s or early 90s. I can't remember exactly. And, you know, I had a mate of mine who was raving about it. You know, oh, you got to read this, got to read this. And I finally read it, and I thought it wasn't bad, but it wasn't one of those ones that grabbed me. So I haven't sort of read any much more in the way of cards stuff. So, you know, the whole revelation that some people who've read all his fiction and not sort of known who he was, that have been rather let down by, you know, finding out your writing author is actually the boogeyman under the bed or whatever.
Yeah, and there's the other aspect of it too, which is kind of interesting, is if you've read the book, you know the twist.
Yeah.
And is there more to it than that?
Yeah, I've never read the book, so I don't think it was funny. I was sitting there thinking, have I actually read any of Card's stuff? Because it's one of those things. I suspect I might have one or two of Card's books in my bookshelf, but I've got like 300 or 400 books I haven't read, and I'm a glacially slow reader.
Right.
So
you just got to live for a long time, mate.
Yeah, that's it. But there is that hard thing too, like Groucho Marx behind the scenes was a bit of a prick.
Yeah.
So it's one of those things of sometimes you need to be able to divorce the artist from their work. At the same time, I know myself just from readings I've done over the years that, yeah, as you said, Orson Scott Card's written a lot of homophobic stuff and very much right-wing propagandist stuff. And it's like, well, I can read people who are, you know, writing stuff that I will enjoy.
Yeah. And it's not like we're lacking for science fiction films to see at the moment.
And no. I think the studio is probably hoping, you know, because I think the Ender's Game or the Ender books, I think there's about 5 or 6 of them. And I think they were sort of hoping that if this takes off, there's, you know, instant franchise, away we go. And weren't sort of counting on the, I suppose, the side effects of having the writer get involved publicly. So,
yeah, and that's the thing. It's Lionsgate, I think, should have done their homework and should have realised that in an age of social media, you can't get away with that shit anymore.
Hmm.
Yeah, which kind of makes for an interesting thing. I mean, I know there are any number of fanboys and fangirls out there that will go to see it automatically because it's a science fiction film and they like the books without considering the other aspects of it. But for me, I've got room to discriminate.
Yeah.
I think it will probably, you know, I don't think it's going to be a flop, but I don't think it's going to make enough money to warrant them moving on to a sequel. You know, I could be wrong. I've seen, you know, there are some movies that come out and you go, really? You're making a sequel to that?
Well, hopefully it'll be a direct-to-video sequel.
Yeah, and then, yeah, other times you hear stories about some of the money, like John Carter supposedly had $100 million spent on it in advertising, and it's like, I don't know where they spent it, but, and because of that, it didn't make all its money back, so they considered it a flop, so, you know.
Well, eventually it did. It made it just about broke even, but it took a long time for it to break even.
And I actually really liked John Carter. It's a flawed film, but it's still a really enjoyable flawed film. And compared to a lot of the big budget, you know, all these big budget blockbuster tentpole films that we've had coming out in for like the last 5 or 10 years, the special effects were actually decent.
Mm. They were extraordinarily good. They were kind of state of the art at a time when the state of the art is very wonderful. I mean, I think Taylor Kitsch is a bit too Keanu Reeves for my taste.
Mm.
But apart from that, I can't see a flaw in it.
No, I saw it when I was half asleep, and I still really enjoyed it. And it was fun.
I remember going to see Independence Day with you at the first midnight screening, and we were right down the front row of the seats. It was at Knife Point, yeah.
Yeah, I hated that film.
Yeah, it was not that good, was it? Yeah, I really watched it about a year and a half ago, and I thought, no.
I actually enjoyed it more when I saw a few years ago when I watched the director's cut or the extended edition. I actually thought that it was actually a more entertaining film than the one I saw at the cinema. It's still not a good film, but I enjoyed it more. It was a better was better quality manure.
Well, maybe you were tired at the time. But, yeah, it's one of those things where you kind of revisit those tentpole movies of yesteryear, and some of them come up pretty well, but other ones are just, oh, why did I pay money for that?
Well, I think Hollywood's system now where they don't care about anything except the opening weekend. It's all about the opening weekend, and that poisons the films because, you know, like films like Casablanca, that took ages before word of mouth got people going to see it.
Yeah, and Citizen Kane, people almost didn't get to see it because Hearst nearly bought it off the studio. RKO nearly sold it to Hearst to be destroyed.
Yeah, but that's it. Like, some of those films, they got their legs, but it took months for them to get their legs. And now the film hits the cinema, and 3 months later it's on DVD.
Yeah.
It doesn't get a chance for word of mouth to get the word out for the good ones.
Yeah.
And the bad ones, they're just trying to get everyone in on the opening weekend, get their money off them, and then it doesn't matter if they get their bad reviews.
Yeah, it's one of those weird things where it's instant gratification. It's like a whole generation of people have become a movie studio. Well,
there was a thing when the last Terminator movie was released, so however long that was, and one of the studio execs was having a big whinge about people that were tweeting from the cinema saying how bad this movie was. And he was sort of decrying the ills of social media and everything. And, you know, I think that's the thing that you can't just fob the crap movies off on people straight away. But the counterpoint to that is that when the movie is a good movie, they've shuffled it along for the next, you know, next song in the playlist before people get a chance to see it.
Yeah, and that's it. And social media is a wave. I mean, you either surf it or you drown.
Yeah.
Mm.
And I mean,
you've really got to embrace it.
Yeah, you look at movies. I mean, how many months was Star Wars in the cinema back in the day?
Too many.
And then you get too many. And then you get sort of the big budget movies like, even things with Lord of the Rings and stuff like that, that, you know, were in and out within, you know, 2 months gone.
Well, I know original Star Wars, even in Australia, original Star Wars was in the cinemas for well over a year.
Yeah.
Well over a year, because I didn't see it until a long time after it had come out.
Yeah, but you've also got to remember, too, that original Star Wars came out just before VHS.
Oh, yeah.
People didn't have another option to pick it up later on. So if they did want to see the movie again, their bum had to be in the seat in a big room with the lights turned off.
Yeah, but you are still getting people now who will go to the cinema multiple times to see a movie just because they love it.
I'll go multiple times because I usually go like the day after it comes out, and then I'll go the following weekend with Jamie and Sarah or a bunch of other people.
Other people pay for their tickets, Terry.
I pay for my tickets. I don't have the media profile to get free tickets.
Running the junket bandwagon?
I have not got anything. The only thing I've got from a junket was a barramundi dinner in Darwin. And that was paid for by Ivor rather than the studio. The stuff I do in the media is for the ABC. They don't have a lot of money.
Well, that's true, yes.
Mm. It's not like I'm sucking at the commercial tit. But speaking of Star Wars, is anybody at all enthusiastic for these J.J. Abrams Star Wars movies that are coming out?
Yeah, about that.
We'll answer that question.
Yeah,
because
I think he does, as a director, he can do some good stuff. I finally got around to seeing Super 8 earlier this year, which I quite enjoyed. And it sort of, I suppose it's, to me, it was more like not a grown ups, but a teenager's, E.T. And cause I was never a fan of E.T. myself. So
neither was I.
But you know, his goddamn lens flare just shits me to tears. but you know, having seen his interpretation of Star Trek, as opposed to you know sort of the older stuff and how that has come through in its various incarnations, I think it's one of those ones that you've got a guaranteed market that will go and see it no matter how crap it is, but I can't say that I'm actively looking forward to it.
No, neither am I. I've never been a Star Wars fan, and I've had people scream at me about some of the things I've said about Star Wars, which delights me no end. But, yeah, it's just one of those things. It's kind of like, why bother? That's the last century. Let's try to find something for this century.
I don't mind that they're doing more films, but I don't know. I look at Abrams, and he does action without much in the way of real story or character.
Yeah.
And,
yeah.
You know, Star Trek Into Darkness sort of tried to manage it, but, yeah, it's like people used to talk about, was it Alias, that TV series?
Yeah.
I tried to watch through the first season, and it just, it may get better later on, but the first season killed it for me just because it seemed like every other episode she was, my dad's a bastard, my dad's a bastard, my dad's a bastard, and then all of a sudden it'd be like, oh no, he was acting that way because of this, oh my dad's wonderful, and then there'd be another twist, and oh no, my dad's a bastard again. And it's like, and this seemed to be happening every couple of episodes. It's like, that's not character development.
No. It's like James Bond, every secret agent should be an orphan.
Yeah.
It's the only way to do it. You don't get those family dramas. You concentrate on the important stuff. And, I mean, for me, new Star Wars movies are kind of like rolling a dog turd in glitter. Why the fuck would you?
It was funny. I recently watched Cube, and then I watched another film a few days later called Altitude. And they're very similar films in that it's a small group of people in a weird, surreal, high-stress situation. And they're not quite even sure how they got where they ended up. And the difference between the films was notable just because of the characters. Cube had really interesting, multifaceted characters, which as the film went on, you learnt more about them. And you learnt dark secrets, and you learnt, you know, quirks of character and all this sort of stuff. And it really works on that level. This group of people in a high-stress environment. Altitude started off with three guys who were all assholes and their girlfriends who were passable. And at every point during the film, every character makes at least one really stupid bad decision. And so I watched Altitude, which is essentially, you know, it's not the same film as Cube, but, you know, the same thing, people in a high-stress situation. And it was almost unwatchable because the characters were crap.
Yeah. And this That's another example of a really good one in that kind of thing. The Mist, Frank Darabont's The Mist.
Mm.
It's got some incredibly vivid characters in that supermarket, Marcia Gay Harden blowing everyone else off the screen. And the characters are what carries it through, even though you've got that spooky shit happening outside.
Yeah, and this is why a lot of the big directors now are doing, you know, TV miniseries and all that stuff, because they're not getting to do anything decent for film. Film's become, for a lot of things, film has become this sort of, you know, poor cousin storyteller, whereas the directors and the writers are getting to actually do stuff with growing characters and interesting, multifaceted people.
Well, I saw a comment the other day that said you can tell that things have really changed when Netflix is now getting nominated for TV Emmys.
Yeah.
Mm.
And more power to them. I mean,
oh, look,
their business model is changing because of the technology changing, so they're being very smart.
Yeah, and that's the thing, that, you know, they've got the clout that they can say, no, this is what we want to do, and not have, you know, a bunch of, you know, pigeonhole execs saying, oh, but we've got to have, you know, more token, you know, racial something, or women this, or we've got to have a kid in it, or a dog, or a, you know, whatever, and just like get the hell away from it.
Yeah, the interesting one at the moment that I'm looking forward to is Guardians of the Galaxy, because I've got James Gunn, the director, as a Facebook friend, and I'm also following him on Facebook as well. The two different things. And there are some interesting hints coming out about what they're going to do with that movie. And having seen what he did with Super, I'm really, really looking forward to that as a total off-the-wall, way-outlier kind of Marvel Universe movie.
Mm. Have you seen the specials?
Yep, I've seen the specials as well. James Gunn again.
Yeah, and
I did it for this podcast.
Yeah, well, that's it. Yeah. The specials and things like that. Gunn as a writer is a really good writer. He writes really interesting characters and does interesting things with them. And as a director, he's not half bad either. So yeah, Guardians of the Galaxy. Yeah, it might fall in a heap, but at least it's someone who is. Hopefully, if he's allowed to do things his way, will take some interesting risks and do some interesting things.
I think that he is taking those risks, and I think the studio is supporting him in it because he took it to them what he wanted to do with it. And they knew that they could get the technical side of it done, you know, the talking raccoon and all that. But his choice of actors is really interesting too. He's got some very, very fine character actors in there, which is going to make it a lot of fun. And then, of course, this sets up all of Phase 2 of the Marvel Universe taking over cinema.
Mm.
And then hopefully we'll see the stuff I want to see, which is like a Doctor Strange movie and a Luke Cage Power Man.
I'd love to see a really good Doctor Strange movie.
Yeah, the Eye of Agamotto going bug fuck at people. Yeah.
Just a really weird, surreal, dark universe and Strange in the middle of it.
I would love to see it, but I'm not going to hold my breath.
No,
it'd be lovely, particularly if they follow the Steranko kind of artwork and do a bit of Steve Ditko and a bit of Steranko in there. It's going to be mind-blowingly good, and they've got the technology now to do it.
Well, that's it. With the computer effects and things like that, they could do that stuff, but also they could give them the beauty of, like, the artwork from you know, those early Ditkos and things like that was, it was very, very simple, but that just made the strangeness of the places that they were sticking Doctor Strange even weirder.
Yeah, I mean, the character arc's not entirely dissimilar to Iron Man, but I think there are enough points of difference that it's really going to be able to work in the right hands.
One of the things I want to see is, look, and hopefully we'll get it with the next one in the DC franchise, can we please, please, please have a Superman or Batman film that doesn't give us their bloody origin? They're two of the best-known characters in the world. I think the Superman symbol has been said to be the most recognisable symbol in the world, with Batman just behind it. And it's like, we don't need their backstories. Just jump us in with a really good story. That's all we need.
I mean, I didn't really understand this Batfleck backlash. People saying Ben Affleck can't play Batman. I didn't understand that. I think Affleck's a very fine director and a pretty good actor.
Mm.
And I think that he could bring to it what it needs. It's really, I don't understand why people are kind of saying, oh, this is the guy that did Genie.
But look, I mean, when Heath Ledger got cast as the Joker, there were people bitching for months going, oh my God, you know, Brokeback Batman and all this sort of, and it just got, you know, some fanboys got stuck into his head going, you know, can't do whatever, and they're all having a whinge about it. I mean, you know, casting choices. I mean, even Michael Keaton, when he got cast as Batman, people were saying he's going to be absolute crap. I thought he was actually a great Batman. So
yeah, George Clooney was a shit Batman, but George Clooney's done other good things.
Clooney can play a good Bruce Wayne, but Batman, no.
No.
See, I thought Clooney was okay, but the problem was, you know, he was trapped in a dog of a movie. There's that famous behind the scenes thing where apparently Clooney and the guy who played Robin, yeah, they're doing the press junkets and you're meant to talk up the film, and they basically went, the film's rubbish, what are we going to do? And then one of them hit on the idea, the sets are amazing though. The set design is fantastic. So all through the press junket, they're not saying it's a brilliant film, they're saying wait till you see the sets.
Yeah, and Clooney was trapped in a ship movie and also in a bat suit with nipples.
Yes.
Yeah. Mm. But it also had the what you'd call the Spider-Man 3 problem, where you've got too many villains and everybody's trying to have their, you know, 10 minutes of screen time, and you've got nothing left for the actual main character.
Yeah, and I think the big problem is they let Joel Schumacher have his head. Very fine director in certain contexts, but he went way too camp.
Yeah, well, yeah. The preceding film, the Riddler's probably my favourite Bat villain, and I think the Joker is actually a better villain in many ways, but I love the Riddler. And but when you've got the Riddler and Two-Face, Two-Face is a much more interesting character and a much more interesting villain than even the Riddler. And they had Two-Face effectively being the Riddler's sidekick and more than that. And it's like, no, if it's worth having this villain in your film, it's worth having just that villain in your film.
Yeah.
If they're good enough to be in the movie, do them the justice of having them in the movie one-on-one against the bad guy, against the Batman.
Though I did very much like Uma Thurman playing Poison Ivy in that Batman movie.
Oh, I forgot
she was quite...
That was the next one.
Yeah, but either way, I like...
Hello?
Yes. No, we're still here. I'm here. I don't know. Is Terry still there?
Am I here now?
Yes, you are.
There we go.
I've hit the little red button, okay?
You muted yourself. Is that what it was?
I muted myself to let you guys have your head. But, I mean, I'm looking forward to anything the Marvel franchise does. I don't mind Thor Dark World. I'm looking forward to the Winter Soldier.
Yep.
Yeah.
And I'll go with them.
I don't know. I think Marvel is very hit and miss. They struck gold with Iron Man. There is absolutely no doubt that, Iron Man is probably going to be the one to beat if they can ever get that good again. But I mean, Captain America as a comic never got me. Just the whole jingoistic, you know, rah rah USA, USA, America. Not my sort of thing. But the first Captain America movie, I thought worked well.
It did.
But to counterpoint that, I mean, you've had what, two Fantastic Four movies, which were average to say slight things about them. We've had another go. Actually, the last Amazing Spider-Man movie wasn't bad, but they just sort of dropped the ball a bit. It had a good script, but
I think basically the Amazing Spider-Man movie was, why do it?
I think that was the problem, that they made so much about making it a reboot that it got in people's faces saying, I mean, you know, it's like, I suppose, a James Bond movie. If you have a new actor playing James Bond, you don't start talking about a reboot. You just say, we've got somebody else playing James Bond. You don't have to go on and bang on about it being a reboot.
I mean, there's a phenomenon that Tom Wolfe identified about 30 years ago called information ricochet, which is intense nostalgia for something that only just happened.
Yeah.
And I think that...
And that was only, eight years,
I think, yeah.
I didn't think it was that long, but...
It was somewhere...
You know, it was fairly recent, and there's certainly amongst my friends, I don't know about the general public, but, there's a big sort of backlash against reboots for the sake of reboots.
There was a thing in Crack magazine that I've actually written down to mention, on why they shouldn't do remakes and reboots. Particularly, they're talking about things like RoboCop, which is coming up. They had 4 points they made.
I noticed they've released the new trailer for RoboCop. I noticed that the formerly completely black bodysuit armor has suspiciously been CGI'd to look more like the original now.
A little bit, yeah. I mean, the 4 points they bring up about reboots is they aren't very good and don't make a lot of money. They take us further away from the original concept, which is a valid point. The message wasn't meant for us. It was meant for somebody 20 years ago or 30 years ago. So basically the reason the movie RoboCop was about 80s corporate greed, it's not about post-millennial corporate greed, which we take for granted. And remakes don't inspire us to dream about the future. They make us nostalgic for the past.
It's also that thing, though, it's like they keep remaking films that were based on books. as well, which gets me. It's like the remake of Solaris.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's based on a book. So why? Mm. And I was sitting there going, oh, great, they're going to base it on the book. And no, they based it on the film. And there's been a few...
The original film was good, though.
The original film's awesome. Yeah, I'm not joking here. I was literally... It took me 3 goes to get through the new film. I can sit through the 3-hour original Russian one in one sitting. It's just crazy. But, yeah, there's been a few films in recent years where what they've done is they've rebooted or remade the film. They haven't gone back to the source material of the book. So, like, we had...
Yeah, Total Recall. Yeah,
I Am Legend, which... You know, it was
essentially
a remake of the Omega Man.
Yeah.
I was going to say, to be fair, that was the first I Am Legend movie. That was the first I Am Legend movie that actually mentioned vampires.
Yeah. Though, the Vincent Price one.
Omega Man and No, they were mutants.
Yeah.
The Omega Man and Last Man on Earth. They were mutants or something like that. They skipped over the vampire thing. So
the Vincent Price one's the most accurate adaptation of the
yes,
original
yeah.
book.
Yeah,
but it's also really dull.
Yeah, and it's also got that weirdness because it was filmed in Italy.
Yeah, I know. I like that.
Yeah, I do too. I think it adds to the spookiness of it. And but that's the thing. And the thing is that we don't lack for new material to make genre films out of as well. There are some great things. Things like Bone Shaker, Sherry Priest's novel, would make a great movie with a strong female protagonist.
And that's the other thing, that there is, even if we skip over the lack of original movies, because I'm struggling to find, you know, I'm trying to find something that hasn't been based on a book or a comic or, you know, on something or something that's actually an original storyline. And
well,
Was it?
Yeah.
Okay. Oh, well, there you go. But you know, when we start sort of digging out the, I think we had a Footloose remake not so long ago. There was they did a remake of Fame, and all these things. So I'm going, why?
Yeah.
Yeah. It's not like okay. Yes, the movies, the original around were hits because they captured the essence of, you know, I mean, Footloose was big in the 80s, but yeah. I can't really see it as a relevant, you know, I mean, you could retool it to make it relevant today, but there's so much other information that if you need to adapt a new novel or a new comic, you know, I mean, there's, World War Z, I didn't actually realize was based on a book. Although, you know, they changed so much of it that you could argue that it wasn't based on the book anyway. But
yeah, they had a whole third act set in Russia.
Apparently they sort of, the test audiences went, And no, they went back and reshot.
They couldn't get the budget to do the CGI. Couldn't get the CGI budget. They were talking about it recently, and they had a whole third act set in Russia, which was mind-blowing.
The reshoots cost an extra $20 million or something?
Yeah, I know that, but it would have cost them about 40 or 50 to do the Russian CGI stuff, apparently was going to be not unlike the Israel scenes, but times 100.
Right.
Yeah, so they went with that third act, which turned it into basically a haunted house movie.
Yeah. Again, there's plenty of stuff around that could be adapted into good movies if you're stuck on original story ideas.
Yeah, but the thing is that
people
play it safe. I mean, the studios want to make money, and some studios are a lot more timid than others.
Yeah.
Well, this is the thing.
Although,
hang on, what were you saying, Danny?
This is the thing that struck me when I watched Whisper in Darkness and Call of Cthulhu. Yeah, these are films made in a completely different style that a mainstream studio would not dare do. But I assume, given that they're made by fans of H.P. Lovecraft, have tried to be as faithful to the spirit of the original stories, if not the original stories, as possible. I've read Call of Cthulhu, and that one was reasonably faithful adaptation. But think the cinemas would... I think the movie studios would be better off, rather than trying to make their money back on films that are, you know, $200 million films. Make $50 million films. Make films that are good, interesting character pieces that aren't held up by special effects alone.
Yeah.
You know, and
that comes back to something.
We want to watch people.
Yeah. That comes back to something that happened when I was in the States in 98. I get to a convention in San Diego, right? And they stick me on a panel. They rush me through the corridor, stick me on a panel with a whole bunch of Hollywood movie professionals, not your top line ones, but like middling professionals. I think the producer of Space Truckers was on the panel. And I was moderating the panel. Yeah. And they start talking about how you've got to have these overblown special effects and all that, and you've got to spend so much of your budget on special effects because the audience expects it. And I piped up with my little Australian accent and said, who created the expectation? And that took them on a different tangent, where they went, yeah, you're right. Lucas and those guys created the expectation for eye candy above all else. And that's where science fiction cinema got off track for a very long time and is only now starting, in some ways, to come back.
Yeah. Well, yeah, I mean, well, Transformers movies are the epitome of eye candy.
Yeah,
Moon is awesome.
Definitely. Moon is mind-blowingly good.
And
David Bowie's kid did well.
Yeah, and that's it. I mean, most of the effects in that are, you know, it's like forced perspective sets and genuine model work where they've only used CG to do things like hide matte lines or add in, you know, dust from the diggers going along the moon. That's it. There are ways of doing this. When you're doing wall-to-wall CGI, that's a problem. I'm a big fan of computer graphics. I always have been. I love computer graphics. But even I know you are better off with a physical model and using the CG to offset it a little bit or to do other things with it. There are things that computer graphics just can't do just because eyes find the flaws, or rather our eyes find the perfection.
Which was the interesting thing they did with... Sorry?
I was going to say, our eyes see the perfection in it, and we can even tell, even when things are imperfect, quite often it still looks too right, if that makes sense. And it's only now that I'm finally starting to see, you know, and we're over 20 years since CG really started making it into the cinema, I'm finally starting to see CG that I can't tell is CG at a glance.
Yeah, that's what they did with Avengers. They did it. Mark Ruffalo did all of the movements for the Hulk, and they motion captured him and basically morphed Mark Ruffalo into the Hulk. And that makes such a difference from the previous two Hulk movies.
Dr. Banner, now might be a really good time for you to get angry.
That's my secret, Captain. I'm always angry.
Which is one of the reasons, besides seeing him in Now You See Me, where he was brilliant, I want to see a Hulk movie with Mark Ruffalo.
Yeah.
Because I think as an actor, he's got it. He's got the tortured Bruce Banner bit.
Do you think a Hulk movie can work on its own?
I think a Hulk teaming up with somebody movie could work.
Because they've had two bites at the Hulk cherry, none of which have worked. We had... The
Eric Banner.
I was going to say, you know, we've had the Avengers movie where we've brought in as an ensemble cast, they work really well. But I think, you know, Hawkeye as a standalone movie, I don't think would work.
No,
could be just me. But yeah, I don't know. As Hulk as a standalone movie, they've tried twice. You know, is it one of those ones that they just need the right story, or is it just he's a character that people aren't going to want to see by himself?
I think there should be a Hulk teaming up with somebody movie, like a Hulk and Thor movie or something.
See, whereas I think they did the Hulk on his own with a TV series. The first couple of seasons of the original Hulk TV series are actually quite good. There's some good storytelling there. You know, it has its issues because it's 1970s television.
Yeah.
But at the same time, they concentrated on people stories. Because if you've got a film that's, you know, hours and hours of the Hulk bashing the shit out of thing, you're going to make a lot of 12-year-old boys happy, but no one else.
Yeah.
Though I do think the first Hulk movie, the Ang Lee one, had moments of wonder.
Oh, the first Hulk movie is a brilliant character drama that just happens to have the Hulk in it.
It's got Shakespearean aspects to it as well, which is really interesting.
I think the thing that hurts that film is the ending. The esoteric nature of it grows and grows and grows and grows until we get this ending where, you know, he's fighting his father and merging with his father and what happened?
Yeah. And the second one, it just turned into, like, hell up in Harlem.
Yeah, and look, two CGI effects beating the snot out of each other just doesn't work for people. Not for most people.
Which is why the first Terminator movie is the only one that worked.
Sorry, what was that, Paul?
I said you can play Street Fighter and get that.
Yeah.
Yeah. And that's why the first Terminator movie beats all the other ones. Because having some nasty monster chase Arnold Schwarzenegger and a kid and a woman around is nothing. Watching people trying to get away from a pumped up Arnie is much more interesting dramatically.
Well, I think comparisons between Cameron's first Terminator and Spielberg's Duel. Arnie is the truck. And it's that same sort of thing. It's, you know, you're just trying to get away. This thing that keeps coming and coming and coming.
I rewatched it a few weeks ago. I finally got a Blu-ray, and it holds up really well as an action flick. And it's got that escalation where at first you don't know quite what's happening, and Sarah Connor finds out another Sarah Connor got killed, and she's just basically an early 20-year-old slacker in a sense. And she's got a great character arc throughout the movie, and becomes something else entirely.
Yeah.
And it's just following her journey, let alone all the great bits of monster work, is an intrinsically interesting thing.
And Cameron was really clever in that movie too, because all the exposition takes place during the action scenes. Mm. So they're in a car and they're driving and they're trying to get away from the Terminator, and Reese is explaining what a Terminator is.
Mm.
You know, and that's really clever filmmaking, because what you usually get is action scene, stop for exposition. Action scene, stop for exposition.
And instead of having all the kind of comic, oh, look out, ah, kind of stuff in the car chase, they used it fruitfully.
Yeah.
I think Cameron's got off the track with his Smurf movie, but I think there's nothing to say that he won't get back on track at some time in the future.
Dances with Smurfs.
That was my biggest problem with Avatar, was just that it's a film that we've seen 400 times before.
Yeah.
Yeah, it could have been really different. In fact, if you just started it out like that, you know, Dances with Smurfs, and then went, right, now we're going to play with the tropes, and we're going to mess with all the audience expectations of where this is going, that would have been a really interesting movie.
You know what would be interesting now for a sequel?
Go on.
Pandora gets invaded by predators.
Oh no!
Avatar versus Predator. That would be fucking kick ass. I would see that movie.
Actually, given that the whole planet is full of it's very full of large life forms, getting the aliens on there would work.
Yeah, it'd work. I mean, anything like that. Take it out of the lovey dovey, you know, crippled guy falls in love with the elf chick kind of thing, and I would definitely see an Avatar versus Predator movie.
That's actually one of the things that really pissed me off about Avatar, is for a film that could not be made without science, and for a film that's base story is built around the science that, you know, this guy can be in a different body and all that, it is so anti-science at times.
Unobtainium.
Yeah. Oh, that doesn't bother me. Yeah, that's Cameron.
Unobtainium worked a lot better in The Core, which, even though the science was shit, is one of my favourite science fiction movies, because it's got the spirit of, let's fix this fucking problem.
What I love about The Core is that the guys who made it said, hey, look, we had to fight to keep the film as good as we did. You know, we had the movie studio saying, can't they have a windscreen that I can see outside? And the movie studio wanted one of the guys to do a lava walk in like a spacesuit.
Mm.
And they said, you can't do that without dying, and that happens in the film. You know, someone goes out and dies because of the heat.
And the other good thing I like about that film is ensemble.
They did that in Star Trek, so...
Yeah. But I love the ensemble in that film, too. They've just got so many cool actors.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, you've got Delroy Lindo, you've got Stanley Tucci, you've got Aaron Eckhart, you've got Hilary Swank, you've got Checky Cario, you've got DJ Qualls. I mean, it's just a beautiful ensemble. They're having fun.
Good character. That's it. Get a good cast of character actors for your action film. Get a bunch of actors that have earned their chops over the decades doing these little bit parts and doing them well, and give them a shot at these things. Or get your new up and coming actors that aren't already big names. Well, all these films where the actor's being paid $30 million to be in the films. Fuck that. Seriously. Mm. What actor is worth $30 million? I'm sorry.
I think, speaking of the ensemble casting, I think that is one of the reasons why Red worked so well.
This place looks fantastic, Victoria. How'd you make the transition?
I love it here. I love the baking. I love the flower arranging.
They retire us.
You can't just flip a switch and become someone else.
What are we supposed to do?
I do take the odd contract on the side. I just can't stop.
Hi, this is Sarah.
It's Frank Moses.
Oh, hey, what's going on?
Not much.
Try a little bit more to the left there. Yeah, it's just perfect.
Why are you trying to kill me?
There's still something wrong with this guy's head.
He was given daily doses of LSD for 11 years.
Well, in that case, he looks great.
Fantastic.
Yeah.
Don't you think we ought to discuss the fact that the CIA is being used as a hit squad? And they'll do whatever they can to find us and kill us?
We're getting the band back together.
Because here these people, they've been doing this shit for decades. And it's like, right, we're gonna put you in a movie where just have fun taking the piss. And, yeah, I mean, they've almost inverted all of their characters. You know, we've got Bruce Willis playing the quiet guy who just wants to try and get away from it all. And we've got, you know, Helen Mirren as the most kick-ass secret agent that you've ever seen.
Yeah, Helen Mirren with a machine gun on there.
And it's just, you know, everyone's going, yep, yeah, more of this, thank you.
Yeah, and it's got Malkovich as well, which is never a bad thing.
I mean, you know, Malkovich is still playing Malkovich, but, you know.
The other one that's got a good ensemble too is X-Men First Class and the new one they're doing. Having Fassbender playing a younger Magneto is fucking terrific casting.
He's great.
Let's just say I'm Frankenstein's monster.
He's really good.
Yeah. He's superb, and the nice thing about it is he doesn't cash a check on it either. He brings his A-game acting to it.
Yeah.
And just those scenes with the intensity of him in there is just a joy to watch.
So, you know, from that to the ridiculous, I watched Mega Piranha a couple of weeks ago.
Oh.
And which is great, Mega Piranha, where the piranhas are doubling in size every 48 hours or thereabouts. But again, it's a film with no real name actors in it, but it's got a bunch of people who have been bit part actors and character actors over the years. And do you remember in the 80s the pop star Tiffany?
Yeah.
Well, she plays the female scientist in it, and these days. She's a woman in her 40s, and because she's not a Hollywood actress, she looks like an average woman in her 40s.
Well, was Mega Shark?
Sharknado.
No, not Sharknado. No, I think was Mega Shark or one of the ones had Debbie Gibson in it, which another 80s teen pop songstress.
Yeah. But that was the thing I loved about Mega Piranha was just that Tiffany's in it. She's playing a scientist. She's effectively the love interest. The film doesn't take itself seriously, and that's fine. But it was just nice to see a woman who's meant to be 40 with the hero who's meant to be around the same age, you know, give or take a couple of years, who actually
age-appropriate casting, yeah.
Yeah, who actually looked their ages. You know, she looks like a woman who, you know, while she's not terribly attractive, she looks like a woman who's been around long enough to know some science.
Yeah, and that's like, that day kind of harks back to the Andromeda strain, where the female scientist is Kate Reed, who looks like a fireplug.
Mm.
But she's the most interesting character in the movie.
Yeah.
Or Brainstorm, which I did recently in this podcast, where you've got Louise Fletcher acting everybody else off the screen.
I haven't seen Brainstorm in years, but that was a really...
It's worth revisiting.
That was the last Natalie Wood one, wasn't it?
It was, with Christopher Walken.
Yes, yeah. Mm. Oh, God.
But Louise Fletcher is fantastic in that film. And, yeah, again, a woman in her 40s, playing a woman in her 40s, but coming to the screen with a well-rounded character.
Well, that, yeah. I think that was the thing that got everybody with, I think, was it World Is Not Enough, with Denise Richards supposedly playing a nuclear physicist? I was like, you know, I know there's a level of suspension of disbelief that you've got to add to a Bond movie, but seriously?
Yeah, it doesn't really work, does it?
I remember Mitch actually talking about when that film came out. He said, you know, Denise Richards is on there.
You're fading out, Denny.
Oh, am I? Hello?
Start again, mate. Yeah, start again.
With World Was Not Enough. Which one was it again? Was it World Was Not Enough?
Yeah, I think so,
Yeah. Well, I remember Mitch saying that Denise Richards was in there as the Bond girl, but as soon as
Sophie Marceau
comes on, you look at Denise Richards and you go, wow, actually, you know what? You're trailer trash. This is a beautiful woman.
Yeah.
Because Denise Richards looks like every other Hollywood actress. She's got the two perfect teeth and the little pointy nose and... Yeah, and forget the fact she's meant to be a nuclear physicist. You just can't take her as a realistic woman because Hollywood is full of all these carbon copy women.
That's one of the horrible things you see in cinema these days, if you look around a little bit, watching women trying to act through the Botox, and men to a certain extent, but just watching them trying to show facial expressions with paralyzed facial muscles, and particularly around the brow and the eyes.
Yeah.
And you can see the start of a line somewhere as their body strains against basically this paralysis they've inflicted upon themselves. It's a horrible thing.
Yeah. Well, one thing I was reading recently about how in Japan there's all these Japanese women that are going in now for plastic surgery and they're getting their features changed quite heavily. And so they're getting the folds removed from their eyes so their eyes look bigger. They're getting their noses made smaller. They're getting their chins made pointier. And it had this whole run of before and after shots. And in all these before shots, you had this range of faces of all those young women that were not unattractive in any way, shape or form. And the after shots, it was like they were clones. They were all going for almost exactly the same look.
Yeah, which Hollywood does well.
There's a GIF that's been doing the rounds of a compilation of all the contestants for the Miss Korea beauty pageant. Now, admittedly, that if you're going into a beauty pageant, you've automatically, I suppose, selected a certain profile of looks and things like that anyway. But, basically this GIF overlays the profile shots of every single entrant to the Miss Korea beauty pageant, and you would swear that it's almost the same person just changing hairstyles all the time.
It's a science fiction world.
Yeah.
Okay, so we probably should wrap it up there. We've done an hour and 10 minutes of wonderful talking. So anything people want to add as a follow-up or a finish or anything like that? Danny first.
Yeah, put me on the spot.
Okay, Paul first.
Sucker, Paul
first. You sound like Arnold Schwarzenegger choking.
Hang on. It's my Bob Hawke doing an Arnold Schwarzenegger impersonation. I think we need to do a follow-up. Talking about TV as well?
Yep, because I've got things like the Almighty Johnsons I want to talk about.
The who's?
The Almighty Johnsons.
You haven't checked out Almighty Johnsons yet?
Who? What? No.
Oh, we're going to have to do that again then.
Oh, Paul, you'd love it. Ancient Asgardian gods living in New Zealand.
Oh my god!
Awesome. Yeah. It is seriously awesome.
Third season's just finishing. Uh-huh. Last episode is next week.
Have to hunt that up.
Mm. So. Yep. So we should do a TV one at some stage. Yes. You guys, let me know when we can do it. We can always pre-record for a later broadcast.
And
have one in the pocket for that. So anything else you want to say, Paul? What's the link to the real thing?
Radio. Radio Reel, RadioReel.org. There's assorted links on there and programming information. I'm doing a lot of TV stuff at the moment, but I'm quietly looking forward to seeing the new RoboCop movie. I'm not holding my hopes up high, but I'll be interested to see it.
Okay, and you and I will have to catch up in the city for a bowl of fur at some stage.
Sounds good.
Okay, and Danny?
I recently discovered Thomas McCarthy as a director. I saw the film Win-Win with Paul Giamatti, which I thought was okay. What I liked about it was it was a small story. It was a story about, you know, a man with his financial problems and a half dozen people. I didn't think it was brilliant, but it was good enough that I thought I'd check out his other work, and his other films are The Station Agent with Peter Dinklage and The Visitor with Richard Jenkins. And,
oh, cool.
And, yeah, Win-Win was the weakest of the films, but it was still good enough to make me check out his other work. And Station Agent is awesome, and The Visitor is a great film as well.
I've seen Station Agent, so I do agree on that, yeah.
Oh, it's a fabulous movie. And, again, he seems to like telling these small stories that are just... They're just people stories. That's all they are. They're just about... These characters in this situation, this is the way their life changes. And either through a decision they make or something they fail to do or whatever else. And it's not a big blown-out melodrama. They're just good people stories. And I think that, yeah, it's really nice to see.
Cool. And for me, as of Thursday after next, I'm going to be back on ABC local radio in Darwin on Thursday nights with Ivor Cole.
Yay.
And... yep, we're going to be in there for half an hour, but I recommend people stream Ivor's show on ABC Darwin because he plays so much old and new cool music. He'll play like roots and blues music 1 minute and then play something newer the next. And he's the most encyclopedic music person I know. I've seen his collection of singles and it fills a double layer of his garage.
Wow.
Yeah, and he's just a lovely guy apart from that. But yeah, that's about it. Thank you very much, guys. We are going to do this again.
Yeah, thank you, Terry.
And I'm more than happy. And that's a good way to keep in touch with both of you retrobates as well. But, okay, well, I'll leave it there. I'm going to do the feedback after I take a break. It's a bit hard to do feedback with you guys on.
Yep.
But I really appreciate you coming on board with the Martian Drive-In podcast, and you're going to be invited back.
Look, thank you very much, Terry, for asking. It was lovely.
Okay, that's about it for this time around. I'm going to leave the feedback until next time, but I'll be back in 2 weeks with another Paleo Cinema podcast, and in 4 weeks with another Martian Drive-In podcast. So everybody stay safe and look after yourselves, and I'll be back in 2 weeks. Bye.